Welcome to the Displacement Urbanism podcast series, hosted through the London School of Economics. My name is Dr. Romola Sanyal, and I am Associate Professor in Urban Geography at the Department of Geography and Environment here at the LSE. In this podcast series, we explore how cities and displacement co-constitute each other. As we see millions of displaced people moving to cities and millions of people displaced in cities around the world, the questions of how these processes intersect are crucial. In this podcast, I will be interviewing a range of actors, including those who have been displaced in different ways and those who are involved in the management and the study of displacement. We will be going around the world to explore the different issues around this topic. I hope the podcast offers an opportunity to open up conversations around the politics and processes of displacement and urbanization, the different ways it can be experienced, understood, and approached. I also hope that the podcast demonstrates how these are global and interconnected issues, but also one that draws our attention to its local specificities. Welcome, everybody, to today's episode of Displacement Urbanism. Our episode today is titled Hmong Refugees and the Remaking of the Twin Cities, USA. I'm delighted to introduce to our podcast, our speaker for today, Dr. Chia Yuyi Vang, who is Professor of History at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Her research is global in scope, but intimately informed by her own refugee experiences as a child. She is interested in not only understanding larger political and military transformations, but also the lived experiences of those who experience wars not of their own making, but fought in their environments. She's the author of four books: Prisoner of Wars, A Hmong Fighter's Pilot Story of Escaping Death and Confronting Life by Temple University Press in 2020, Fly Until You Die, An Oral History of Hmong Pilots in the Vietnam War by the University of Oxford Press in 2019, Hmong America, Reconstructing Community in Diaspora by the University of Illinois Press in 2010, and Hmong in Minnesota by the Minnesota Historical Society Press in 2008. In March 2016, the University of Minnesota Press released her co-edited volume, Claiming Space, on the Agency of Hmong Women. Dr. Vang earned a PhD in American Studies at the University of Minnesota in 2006. Welcome to the podcast, Chia.
Thank you so much, Romola. Thank you so much for having me.
It is such a privilege to have you on here. I am so excited to talk to you today. And I know that you've done all this amazing work, and I know that so much of it has been influenced by your own history and your own life experiences. So I wanted to kind of have a conversation around that. So I wanted to really just start with a general kind of discussion about how the Hmong came to settle in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul in Minnesota, please.
Yeah, such a pleasure to be here to share this very personal, but yet, you know, larger history. How the Hmong came to the Twin Cities is very much a reflection of post-Vietnam War refugee resettlement. As many of you know, that, you know, millions of people were displaced, and the Hmong are from Laos. We are an ethnic minority group in Laos. And unfortunately, or fortunately, during the war, we became entangled in what is called the U.S. Secret War in Laos. So many people thought, why are the Hmong people here? And wait, they're in Laos, but this is the Vietnam War, and they're Vietnam War refugees. But for those of us who lived it, those who fought it, whatever happened in Laos was very much in direct support of the war in Vietnam. So because many Hmong were, that's during the Cold War, and so people could not be neutral, right? You have to be on one side or the other. Being neutral was not an option. So very long story short, that my father, uncles, and thousands of Hmong men and boys were recruited to be America's foot soldiers in Laos. And so after the war ended, those who sided with pro-American forces then became targets of oppression by the new regime, and then also fear too. I think over time, we reflect about those who stay and those who left. Those of us who left spent some time in refugee camps in Thailand. And then, in terms of how we ended up in the Twin Cities, federal refugee policies are made at the federal level, but it's states and counties or local government that really help to resettle refugees, and also many voluntary agencies like churches. So, how the Hmong ended up in Minnesota, people often ask me that question, why do the Hmong people choose to come to Minnesota? And I said, we actually did not choose to come to Minnesota, right? It was Minnesotans, right? Church groups, individuals, people who knew nothing about us, right? There's no Hmong country. We are a member of many other countries in the world today, but those of us who live in the United States are from Laos, and its sponsors who the US government dispersed refugees all over the country, not just Hmong, all the other refugees too. But it was sponsors who allowed us to come to Minnesota. The first group that came were the parolees, right? The people who actually worked with Americans during the war. And so the first Hmong family to arrive in Minnesota was in 1975. Dang Her is his name, and his family came. And then after that, the refugee program opened up to Hmong people. And so more and more people just came to the state. They may be resettled in other parts of the country, but what happens with all migration is that people may move to Washington State or California or others, or Iowa, but we all practice chain migration. We're not that different from other groups, right? So people learn that despite the super, super cold weather in Minnesota, sometimes negative 20, it is a nicer environment. There were a great deal of support. Nonprofit, government, state agencies really reached out to support these refugees and help them to rebuild their lives. So that's how we ended up in Minnesota. And it is really chain migration that has really built that community to be, the Twin Cities, which consists of Minneapolis and St. Paul. St. Paul is the capital city, but Minneapolis is a bit bigger. So that is referred to as the Twin Cities. And that now is the largest concentration of Hmong people in the United States.
Wow, that's such a fascinating history, and I'm sure that the audience would love to hear so much more about this. But I wanted to sort of build on that and just ask, given that people have been there over many decades now, if you could talk to us about how that community has developed, socially and politically and spatially as well.
Sure. So this is actually the 50th anniversary of the end of, well, for those of us in Asia, right? The war ended in 1973 with the peace agreement. So it allowed the US to disengage. But for those of us living in, those countries, it didn't end until 1975, right? And so that was where the displacement began. We're coming up on April 30, which, people remember as the fall of Saigon. Depending on, whose perspective, that's usually what people in the Western Hemisphere refer to. So this is 5 decades later. And I do want to say that by 1980, right in 1975, the US government thought, oh, we'll just fly these people who, or evacuate these people who worked with us, and they will be done. We can wash our hands off of these people in so many ways. I can spend 2 more hours on that, but that we can be done, right? The war, we can, the Vietnam War wasn't a good war. All wars in general, I think, are very, very problematic. But the Vietnam War was really the end of American victory culture, right? So it was not a victorious, war where people came back celebrating. So people would have preferred to forget about it. So if you look at all the government documents and discussions in Congress, people thought, we just have this small legislation, the Indochina Migration and Refugee Assistance Act in 1975, to get these people out, and then we can, help that small group. Then we'll be done. But that's not what happened, right? Thousands and thousands of people fled by sea, by land, and tried their best to find refuge elsewhere, right? So by 1980, there have been, 79 and 80 were the biggest years of refugee arrivals. For Hmong, it was just crossing the Mekong River from Laos to Thailand. So that's our refugee experience for Vietnamese and Cambodian. You know, many went by sea into Malaysia and other places. But for Hmong, it was just precisely just to across to Thailand. So they would spend some time in refugee camps. And then by 1980, you would have just over 40,000 refugees from Laos that were considered Highland, right? Highlanders. So 90% of those were Hmong people who have been, you know, moved over to the refugee camp. So I say this with you know, today there are no more refugees coming, right? All of the refugee resettlement ended in the mid-1990s, the UN-sponsored refugee resettlement. So our population, the census counted Hmong people in 1980 as a little over 5,000. By 1990, over 94,000. And then by the 2000 census, counting 186,000. By 2010, we had grown to 260. And by 2020, we're almost 360,000. And there's probably the margin of error is probably, you know, pretty high too. So there might be more because people don't always get counted in the general population, but in particular, groups like the Hmong. So your question about how have they developed, right? The first group who came were generally people who had some education, may not be very high, may just be like middle school, but some knew how to read and write in Lao, if not in a little bit of broken English and maybe some French because of the colonial experience. So the immigrant group or the refugee group, when they came, they fought very hard to advocate for resources for the community. If they needed interpreter, they requested, they demanded it. So it was these immigrant generation that advocated for resources for their community. Okay. So that's how it was in the beginning. But as the community became more educated, as those people who are like me, my family did not come until 1980. So we were actually going to try to stay and rebuild our lives, but many different things that I don't have time to go into today happened so that it forced us to also leave. And we got to Minnesota in 1980 in April. And my uncle was already there since 1976. So it's his generation that created these, you know, volunteer agencies, self-help organizations, advocating for interpreting, like I said, in the schools, at hospitals, all kinds of services. That's what they advocated for. So that's kind of how they build their community. And it's harder for people to be so dispersed, right? And to have that access to that service. So that is one of the reasons why, even if people are resettled in a nice smaller town in northern Minnesota, where one whole church helps one family, they get a lot of support versus, you know, a few people helping a lot of refugees. And it's different in the urban society. But what happened was that people moved to the urban areas, even though it may be more difficult, it may have less, it may not be as appealing. They had more access to resources and support. So the community building began that way. And as the community lived in St. Paul and Minneapolis longer, people began to create their own grocery stores because they couldn't get rice that they wanted to eat. They built community. They eventually worked in manufacturing and all kinds of service jobs. And then eventually are able to purchase their own homes, start their own businesses that cater mostly to the immigrant community. But there's a street called University Avenue that goes straight to the state capitol in St. Paul. I remember in the 80s, they were all boarded up building, right? But many of this community have purchased those old homes, transformed those communities. I'm not saying it's all just Hmong people, but I'm saying tremendous, you know, ways in which they now had the opportunity. So that's how people really began to set down roots. And then once they set down roots, once they had a generation that went to school, went to college, and then by 1991, they started to think about representation more than just having liaisons and this or that. So 1991 was the very first year in the United States that a Hmong person was elected to a public office. I mean, it's a small school board position in the city of St. Paul, but that began Hmong people's fascination and energy into running for political office. Leading to today, you can see Hmong senators at the state legislature, representatives. You can see county supervisors, people at the, local, county, and state representation. At almost every other home you go to in the east side of St. Paul, it's owned by a Hmong person. So that's how they have a really built community. They've started their own kind of Hmong-focused charter schools. They're all public schools, but these are charter schools that, anybody can start. So you have a ton of those. Lots of Hmong in development, business owners increasing the Hmong buying power to over $1 billion in Minnesota. So just a snapshot.
Wow, that is really fascinating. I mean, that's such an incredible journey for the community. I guess as an urbanist, I have to sort of ask, because you were talking about people starting businesses and buying homes and building them and so on and so forth. It sounds like there were so many changes that were happening to the city. So I just wanted to pick up on that point a little bit more. And just ask you, if you could take us on that journey of just kind of talking a little bit more about how the landscape of St. Paul has changed through the community.
Yeah, so one of the ways in which I describe Hmong refugees in particular in the Twin Cities is that, I mean, it happened in other places too, but it's a very unique area, right? California is very different. There's many other Asian groups. So we're kind of just part of other Asians. But Minnesota didn't have the kind of Asian population. So the Hmong are the biggest Asian group in the state of Minnesota and in Wisconsin as well, where I live now. So I think, I remember in the 1980s and 90s when people didn't have as much yet, people really concentrated in some of the most impoverished neighborhoods. And they took over public housing complexes, right? There are places called Liberty Plaza, there's McDonough Housing. These homes had previously been occupied by other low-income whites or, African Americans and indigenous communities as well, as, Hispanics. But when the Hmong came, they really flooded some of these homes. And I use flood because they really took over some of these homes. And that was a way that people could then really support each other. So super concentrated. But I think as people's economic ability change, then they spread, right? Just like anybody else, once people have, a little bit of social mobility, they want to have more space. And then they began to expand a little bit to, a little bit more of the suburban areas. But St. Paul, to me, there's a number of big Hmong shopping centers, right? That didn't exist before. And there's one called Hmong Village. And when you go into this Hmong Village, it's a huge building. There's actually two. There's Hmong Town and Hmong Village. You go into these shopping malls, and if you, I don't know if you've ever been to like Thailand or Laos or others and some other places in Asia, like the inside, you have all these vendors, right? And it's just like that. Like I've gone to Asia many times, and sometimes I go to the Hmong village and I feel like I'm there, right? So bringing Asia, bringing their Hmongness to the space, so changing the ways in which, other people can access, Hmong traditions and kind of Hmong fruits and vegetables and things like that. One of the other big accomplishments or impact I see too, in terms of your question, is that the Hmong are traditionally agrarian. Right. In Laos, I mean, the war changed things quite a bit. People began to have other professions, but all tied to the war, efforts. But we were mostly agrarian community members. So when people came here, people like my father participated in a farming program. Long story short, there was a number of efforts that, well, when they farm, let's support them. So the Hmong have really taken over the farmers markets, right? The local farmers markets in the Twin Cities, in the St. Paul Farmers Market. There's now a Hmong American Farmers Association. And what we've done is introduce, all kinds of different vegetables that before we came didn't exist in those farmers markets, right? We don't own bitter melon. We don't own, pea pod tops, but or squash vines, but we eat them, right? And the people
Right.
don't see the different ways in which we use these vegetables. So again, it's not just about us changing to become part of this community, but I think like many other immigrant groups too, but in particular, a group that when you have a critical mass, right, then you can exert a little bit more of what you want. And so it's not just changing, being changed so that we can be American, but it is also about bringing our own unique, values to also shape that community, a very specific Hmong American community.
So this sounds like, again, like a really incredible story. And, I love the fact that you're talking about not just, the Hmong coming over and settling into these spaces, but also introducing all these different kinds of products and produce and different lifestyles and so forth into these spaces as well. And so there's this kind of meshing of cultures and this wonderful sort of hybridizing of space and sort of practices and so forth. And it's really wonderful. But one of the things that I wanted to ask was in listening to that story was that it sounds like there was a lot of effort put into a lot of this. And clearly it seems like there were a lot of challenges along the way. And I was wondering whether you could talk to us about some of those challenges that the community also faced in the process of, settling down and becoming as successful as they've been.
That's a wonderful question because as much as I am so proud of the ways in which our community, started in this country with very little in the resilience that we have exhibited over the last 5 decades, I don't want to forget all the challenges too. And so the challenges are so long. The list is long, right? When you have a group of people who had very little exposure to, formal education, very little exposure to anything outside of their villages and towns. And then you completely put them in a place that is so different from anything that they're familiar with. I have a long list that I can share, but I'll just name a few. The language, right? Very typical. Most people didn't have formal education anyway, so there is a Hmong written language, but many people didn't know how to read and write anyways, right? So language barrier was one of the biggest one for all. And then you have housing. Many Hmong families are bigger, right? And you have American rules and regulations that in a 2-bedroom house you can only have this many people. Well, if you can only pay, if your benefits or the funding that you have can only pay for a 2-bedroom, but you've got 8 people, how do you make it work? So housing was a huge, huge, huge issue. I also think about the challenges of work. Many companies were so welcoming once they learned about the Hmong's really hard work ethic, right? And then they started hiring them. But at the beginning, people didn't want to hire them. Oh, you don't speak English, you're not educated. So work employment was one of the biggest issues. One of the others is also gender dynamics. We are a very patrilineal society, and then we come here in the ways in which American social policy put the name of the woman on the welfare check, right? And then it kind of changes the dynamic, and it was so, so difficult in terms of cultural practices. And with that too, cultural practices is one of the biggest issues. Some Hmong have converted to Christianity, but the vast majority of Hmong people are animists. We follow animist traditions. They need to have shaman ceremonies. When they have a shaman ceremony or a soul calling, these are all terms that you may not be familiar with, but they're all spiritual healing, ceremonies that we have. And you may have a family that have a shaman ceremony for the weekend, and then you have 2 blocks of people, coming in to share with the event. And then people get really upset. The neighbor gets really upset. That also means that our funerals, right? The cultural practices, funerals, we have funerals for 3 days, right? And so cars are parked around the block and neighbors call the police. It is, those are so many important challenges to remember. Nowadays, we have a ton of Hmong-owned funeral homes that there's no problem anymore, right? It just bother neighbors. But those were some of the major issues that, when people first get here, you're really disoriented. And that's for the parents' generation. But for children like my generation, 1.5, born abroad, but young enough to come here and go to school, I mean, you go to school and you have all these issues and challenges at school because people call you all kinds of names. When you don't know what it means, it doesn't hurt. Okay. But when you learn English and you know what it means, it begins. So there was many fights, and by the late 80s, you began to have a lot of Hmong boys joining gangs, right? So that they can protect themselves against the bullies in their neighborhoods and, playgrounds. So that became a really big issue for, Hmong boys in particular in the 1980s and 90s. It's a little different now. But I do want to say in those early years with children, you struggle, but you can't tell your parents because they themselves can barely, help themselves because they're depending on you to read every letter that comes into the house because they don't know how to read English. So the role reversal of children and parents became, for children, I would have to say for children like me who wanted to just help my parents and anybody else who asked me, you feel really proud that you can do that. But there are many children who do not like that role. So they began to see their parents as less important. And that really changed, the family dynamics as well. So those are just a few of those really major challenges that we've experienced over the course of, especially the first, I think, 20, 25 years. Now it's a little bit different. We have other issues, but not the same issues as when we first arrived.
I wanted to ask, how this refugee experience has impacted your life's journey more generally. And also, just picking up on that, given sort of the current climate that we're in, social, political, economic, what would your message be to those who feel threatened by the presence of others who are displaced and who are coming seeking protection? Because this is such a big discussion nowadays, and in my view, a very disheartening one. What would you say as well in that?
For me, when I think about my experience as a refugee, we were only in the refugee camp for 6 months. I was a child. So we were there long enough to want to remember. I hope that makes sense, right? Many people who stay there for a long time, they want to forget, right? But because we were there for 6 months, processed, and then we came to America. So as a kid, you have fun memories of just running around, tasting soda for the first time. I mean, there's all these new experiences, holding a pen for the first time because I didn't go to school in Laos. So my experience is very unique to me, right? When I think about your question, it's so unique to me. But when I think about, my own research and the millions of people who've been forcibly displaced from their homes, I think about the risk that people take. Right, life-threatening risk that people take to get to foreign lands. That's a very common experience for a lot of people who are displaced, and especially those displaced by wars often generally are in positions where they live in places that they themselves had no decision making in these wars. So that's why I talk about how my research, we were impacted, the wars happening in our neighborhoods, our towns. But the decisions are made on the other side of the world. And when we show up on the other side of the world as political refugees of these wars, for the Hmong, it was a secret war, right? The US or anyone else was not supposed to be in Laos during that era because Laos was a neutral country. But indeed, everybody was there covertly. And so for the Hmong people, when we came to this country, people often ask, why are we here? Right, we don't belong here. We're like poor, we're primitive, we're all these characteristics that you describe people that don't belong in the US nation. So we had to perpetually, over the years, perpetually justify our existence of why we are in this country and why we belong here and why our men and boys died before they even set foot on US soil fighting on behalf of the US nation. So, indeed, that has been my elders, especially the Hmong veterans, that has been their lifetime purpose and fight for recognition for their contributions to the US Secret War in Laos and the sacrifices they made. So, for me, if I think about a message for people today, I do think that regardless of who people are, where they are in the world, we all want pretty much the same thing. We want safety for our families. We want opportunity for our children. We just want to live meaningful lives. And so, for those of us caught in the crossfires of war or other kinds of challenges that force us to leave, I think most people, if you had peace in your country, you wouldn't leave. But the ways in which a lot of people, refugees like ourselves, you leave because you have to leave, because leaving is better than staying. So you do that. So I think for those people who are very against those of us who have become displaced and you can't go back, you can't go forward, you're stuck. I do hope that, people can find it in their, in their hearts to imagine what it would be like for them, what they would like to see for themselves if they happen to be in a situation like that. So for the Hmong people, over the last 5 years, our elders have been fighting for recognition, right? So there's a small memorial in Arlington National Cemetery for like a national, but in the state of Minnesota, there's a memorial that was erected in 2016 after years of, community members, local officials working together to build what is called the United States and Alliance Special Forces in Laos, also known as the Hmong, Memorial, right in front of the state capitol, where the design is a bamboo sprout. And so it's circular. There's images of Hmong life in Laos, the war, the migration, and the resettlement. And then really, for me, that memorial symbolizes the Hmong saying, "We are now claiming this place as ours too," right? That we sacrifice the blood of our men and boys and other people who died, who perished under bombs that don't discriminate against combatants and civilians. We are here, we belong here. And today there's, as I mentioned earlier, there are Hmong people who are lawmakers. They're part of the fabric of American society. And I often don't try to compare Hmong people to other people, or even other Asian people, right? When we compare ourselves just to ourselves, where we began in 1975, 76, with little more than the clothes on our back, I think we have come a very, very long way. But of course, when we compare ourselves to Asian Americans as an aggregate, then we, individually, people are doing really well for themselves. But as a group, we remain one of the most impoverished, Asian American groups. So let's not forget that as well. All the progress that I mentioned are wonderful, but I think there's still a lot of work to be done to make sure that our community is really thriving.
Wow, this has been such a fascinating discussion. I mean, it's such an interesting history, and you've told us such an amazing story about the community and the kinds of struggles that they've gone through and how they have arrived where they have. And I really appreciate also, your own life story in all of this and the wise words that you shared with us. And I really, really hope that for those who are listening, but also for those who may come across this podcast or, this episode in the future, that they think about what you were saying about, if there was peace, people wouldn't leave. And it's important to have empathy for those who are leaving and also appreciate the hardships that they've gone through to be where they are, to rebuild their lives and the enormous implications that it has for generations to come, for those who have left, for their children, for others. And it's no mean feat to start your lives all over again in a completely different part of the world, in a place where the culture and even the environment might be completely different to what you're used to. This is so much to think about. So, thank you so much for sharing your stories with us, Chia, and being on the podcast with us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me to have this conversation with you.